And now our featured speaker, Daryl N. from Orchid, all the way from Orchid.
Wow. I'm Daryl, I'm alcoholic. It's good to be here. Kristen, thanks for asking me to show and giving me the opportunity to come. It's truly a privilege to stand before the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and to share what the grace of my loving God and the process of the 12 steps and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has done for such an undeserving man like me. And not because of me, but in spite of me, you know, I'm here today. And I'm still here. And what a gift that is. My sobriety date is July 10th, 1990. I have a little over 27 years. And I'm working in my 28th year of sobriety. I have a sponsor. His name is Richard G. He's been my sponsor since day one. I outgrow him several times, but he always catches back up. And I tell him that to his face, too. So. I love that guy. If you're new or relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd like to welcome you and tell you you're home. You know, if you're sitting here and you're new and you feel bad, tore up, you're supposed to. That's how we get here. You know, nobody comes here with a success story. I've been to meetings all over the place, and I haven't been to one yet where I hear someone say, yeah, you know, everything's going good. I'm making good money. My wife likes me. I got a good job. And kids love me, and I'm, you know, I'm taking my kids to soccer, and everything's good. And I just thought I'd go to AA and see what they do over there. We get here at the end of a road of pain, misery, isolation, devastation, and for me, a lot of near-death situations, you know, and that's been my experience. And if you're here and you've been here for a while and you feel bad, that's your fault. Because we got a solution. You know, we have a spiritual solution to alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a process of the 12 steps. And you know, the book talks about AA, about alcoholism being a threefold, you know, the allergy, the obsession, and the spiritual malady. And it says that when we focus on taking care of the spiritual malady, then the mental and the physical take care of itself. And that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I'm also a drug addict. And if that bothers you, too bad. And I'm also a Christian. And if that bothers you, you got to deal with that. You know, don't worry, I'm not here to convert you. I will pray for you if you ask me out in the parking lot, but you know, it doesn't bother me if you don't believe. So please don't let it bother you that I do. You know, a little bit about me. There's 8 kids in my family. I'm the 3rd from the youngest. 5 of us have substance problems. 2 of us are sober. My kid brother just did 22 years in prison behind drugs. Now he's strung out in Long Beach on the street somewhere. And I tried to find him around Thanksgiving. I couldn't find him. You know, nothing I could do for him. I just thought maybe I'd go and buy him some clean clothes and get him a meal, you know, because he don't want to change. You know, but I thought I could do that for him. And I wasn't able to find him. And so I went on about my day. You know, I was on my Harley, so I thought, and this is kind of weird because I went down to see my brother for Thanksgiving because I hadn't seen him in over a year and since he got out. And I couldn't find him, so I thought, you know what, I was looking up. I was somewhere and I seen a flyer that said there was a rockabilly car show in New Mexico. And I'm on my Harley. I thought, yeah, it's only like 500 miles, you know. So I was taking off to New Mexico, you know, because I got it like that. You know? And I freaking broke down on my bike in Palm Springs. And this is a fairly new bike. And I was like, well, I used to ride bikes that you would like put together with belling wire and plumber's tape and duct tape and vice grips and radiator hose clamps. And I rode them things everywhere, you know. But you know, this is just to tell you a little bit how my life is today. I break down on the freeway and I'm just outside Palm Springs. And I'm like, okay, So I got a friend that lives in Paris. So I call him. I say, hey, what are you doing? Because this thing sounds like maybe he's not around. And he says, oh, I'm in a casino. Oh, which one? He tells me where. I said, oh, so you're home. He says, yeah. I said, hey, I'm broke down on the freeway. I said, I'm going to try to dead leg my bike to your house. Meet me there. He says, all right. So he did. And we couldn't fix it. We took it to Riverside Harley, and I left it there. And then my daughter-in-law and my son happened to be in Aurora, and they come pick me up. And I only said just because that still blows me away, man. You know, I'm an old transient. You know, the end of my drinking, I weighed 116 pounds. I was living under a bridge in Santa Barbara. And I was begging for food, and I was asking for change. And I walked the streets of Santa Barbara, and I was pretty twisted. And you know, people give you money if you look real twisted. And because they just want you to get away from them. You know? And I used to make my way down to Ledbetter Beach, and I would sleep in the caves, which was good as long as you woke up early, because if the tide came in, it was a swim out. or I'd go to the tule grass down by the railroad tracks, you know, because you could hide from the cops in there, because they messed with us. But I would walk Santa Barbara and I would ask change for the strange. And I would get money, panhandle, maybe get a couple 40s. Head my way down to the park and maybe get a resin hit off a crack pipe. And I was in pretty bad shape. One of the most impactful parts of my life was my father died in my arms when I was 18 from brain cancer. I hadn't been home much. I grew up in reform schools and juvenile centers and YGC, Joplin, Los Pinos. When I was about 14, 15, I was smoking. I ditched school and I boosted a couple bottles of Wild Turkey, I think it was, from Alpha Beta. They didn't have Albertsons then, it was Alpha Beta. And I boosted a couple bottles and I went down to the neighborhood park and I hooked up with a couple homeboys that I knew. And we went to the house, and one dude had some Sherman, which was angel dust. And so we're drinking the booze and smoking dust. And one of the guys said, hey, man, why don't we rob some houses, burglarize some houses? And I said, that sounds like a good idea. We went and burglarized houses. And on the third house, I had gotten guns from the second house. And the third house, I came out, and it was the district attorney's house, and they had silent alarms. And there was cops everywhere, and I got an 18 month program for that. When I got out of that program, my father was dying of cancer, and so I went home a month after my 18th birthday, he died from brain cancer, and I was there, I remember his breath and the way he breathed and the way he looked, and my dad was there. He was a redneck, Okie. World War II veteran, fought in Okinawa, combat veteran. He was a hell of a dude. And what I seen in his face was fear. I seen a lot of fear. And it took me a long time to realize that the fear that he had was because he was leaving and I was staying. You know, because he knew what I was about. And that day impacted my life. That day he died, a friend of mine had shot another friend of mine, shot him in the face with a 12-gauge shotgun. And his funeral was that day. And I was getting out of the shower, getting ready for his funeral, and our 24-hour nurse said, hey, you might want to go sit with your dad for about 20 minutes. I was like, not today, you know. That's just how life was, you know. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew a lot more about dying than I knew about living. So that was like a major impact. And I don't think I've ever been the same. I was young, I was immature. I've been doing drinking and using since I was 12 years old. And I've never had a social drink in my life. I hear people in meetings, they'd be like, yeah, I drink for 30 years and then I crossed a line. And I'm like, I never seen a line, you know? I drink alcoholically from the gate. I have a ninth grade education. I got friends and they're alcoholics and they're like, yeah, I went to this college. I went to, I'm like, how the hell did you go to college? Oh yeah, I played sports and I did. I'm like, what? I couldn't walk. How am I going to play sports? You know? My vocabulary was like, I was inebriated. They took me out of my junior high school bathroom inebriated on Valium and Percocet and alcohol. And I was in the freaking eighth grade. There was no finishing school. You know? I don't understand, you know. But you know, I got sober when I was 27 because of that. You know, I kept trying to die and I wasn't dying. And I wanted to die and I couldn't die. The next major impact in my life was the day I met God. God introduced himself to me. It was after my father died, and probably about 2 years. I think I was about 20 now, 19 or 20. And I'd been slamming a lot of dope, doing a lot of dope, drinking a lot of whiskey. And I had developed a condition called hypoglycemia. And I was going into convulsions. I mean, I'd be talking to you like this, and the next minute I hit the ground like a wind-up toy, you know. And I'd come to, and some dude would be trying to take my tongue out of my throat, you know. And it was getting bad. It was happening all the time. And so I went to a doctor, and it was having gone under a lot of tests. But, you know, a friend of mine that I used to run around with, grew up with since, like, the fourth grade, he had gotten saved. And tell you the truth, it was like he went from carrying a gun to carrying a Bible, and we all thought he just did one dose too many. And, you know, he was different. And I correlate this because I can put it like when Abby came to Bill, you know. And when you read Bill's story, it says, you know, he says that there Abby was standing in front of him. And he asked him what happened because he was different, you know. He had just seen him 3 months before, and he was like, God, you know. And now here he is knocking on the door with his face cleared, speaking clear, clean clothes. And he said, what happened? And he says, I got religion. And Bill's like, yeah, you know, I didn't have, you know. He couldn't grasp that. But he says, I cannot deny that there's something different about this guy. He's changed. It was there in front of him. And that's how it was with my friend, you know. And he was different. And I don't remember how we hooked up, but we hooked up. And I remember him telling me, I told him what was going on, and I was afraid, man, because my father had just died a couple years. I was convinced I had a brain tumor. And I was like, put some tinfoil on, and it'll go away. That's a tweaker joke if you don't know. And if you don't know what a tweaker is, don't worry about it. And he told me, I remember we were sitting in the car, and he told me, he said, Daryl, Jesus loves you, man, and he wants to heal you, and he wants to save you. And I told him, Don, you know, I ain't about all that. You know, I said, you know what I'm about. You know who I am. And I'm not going to play games. And he says, no, brother, he says, God loves you, man. And I'm like, not me, bro. And we talked for a while, and I had great love for this guy. And I had buried his brother. His brother had been living with me, and I found him dead in bed. He had died from bootleg Quaaludes, died in his sleep. He told me, he asked me something. He says, Daryl, make me a promise. He says, when you go into your house tonight and you go to bed, he said, get on your knees and ask God to reveal himself to you in a manner that you can understand. And he said, do it every day until he does. And I'm all, Don, you know I ain't buying that. It was just do it. And I was like, all right. So I did. You know, I went in that night and I got on my knees and I said, God, you know, I don't know who you are, what you are, or if you're real, if you're not real. I had a lot of, like, I seen a lot of bad stuff out there. And I was like, I couldn't fathom this, you know. And And I said, but if Don says you're real, I said, then show yourself to me and reveal yourself in a manner that I can understand. And nothing happened. And I went to sleep. And I did that for a couple of days. And it was the third or fourth day. I had been back to the doctors, and they had given me my results of my tests. And they said I was hypoglycemic, and I would be on a diet the rest of my life. And I would do, you know, I could, if I changed my lifestyle, that I would be all right. And that day I talked to my friend Don, and he said, how have you been praying? I said, yeah. I said, but it ain't nothing happening. And that night I went back in the house and I got into bed, started to go to sleep, and I thought, oh man, I got out of bed and I got on my knees and I said, God, if you're real, reveal yourself to me in a manner that that I can understand. If you're real, like Don said you are, then show yourself. I'm tired. And forgive me. Forgive me for all I've done. And I laid down in the bed and I felt a warm blanket just cover me. And I smelled a sweet fragrance in the air. And I felt loved. And that was the day God introduced himself to me. I'd like to say that I stayed clean and sober from that point forward, but I did not, you know. I still had another 7 years of drinking and using after that. Some things that happened, and I got really busy in the church, and I did a lot of things. I've seen a lot of miraculous things happen in a real short period of time. But through facing a death, I blamed God for that death, and I walked away from the church, and when I did, I went full-blown right back to what I do. So that was my introduction to God. And now I'm going to get sober. I had gotten married. I met a normie. I don't know what the heck she was doing with me. I had some kind of game back then. I think she just liked the bad boy thing, you know. So I met her, and she was prim and proper, Air Force brat, didn't drink, didn't use. And I thought she was going to fix me, and I married her. And we had a couple kids, and I didn't know I'd be a kid. I was a nutcase, man. I was a drug addict and alcoholic, and I couldn't quit drinking. I was smoking crack, I was smoking dust, and smoking speed, Norton Harrell. I mean, you name it, I was a garbage pail. I was doing it. And she used to tell me, Daryl, don't you love us? Can't you stop? And I couldn't stop. I said, yeah, I love you. I can't stop. That went on for a while, and then she ended up leaving me. And then I went to jail. I got 8 drunk drivings in 3 years. I ended up in jail. The drunk drivings were, I don't really know why I like to drunk drive, because I'm not going nowhere, but I'm going somewhere. I gotta go. Something's happening somewhere and it ain't here. I got my 8th drunk driving. I hadn't been to the arraignment on my 5th yet. I still had the tickets in my pocket. And my last one, I was in Santa Barbara, my last one, I was on the 101 freeway just past the State Street turnoff, and they pulled me over, and I just locked the doors. I just locked the doors, and I'm all, I ain't talking to them. Not today. And he was tapping on the glass. Stupid. I was telling that guy here, I got a lot of stuff to talk about, man. Anyway, he's like, you roll this window down, I'm going to take you and this truck to jail. I'm like, oh, he ain't going away. He ain't leaving. So I roll the window down, open the door, he put his knee against the door, and he's all, no, man, get out the other side, I don't want you getting ran over. And I crawl out the other side, and I shut the door, and I'm hanging on the handle like this. You know?
He's like, why are you driving? I'm like, I can't walk. I'm not letting go of this handle. And I'm a drunk. Alcoholic sounds pretty. I'm a drunk. I'm a bad drunk. When I drink, I don't care. When I take the drink takes me. And I don't have any say about the outcome. It's going to be bad, and it's going to affect a lot of people, and I don't know how long it's going to last. But I got no control over it. There's a darkness that lives in me that compels me to get on a path of destruction, and it harms everything in its way. And when it's triggered, I'm out of control. And it doesn't matter whether I care about you or don't care about you. If you're too close, you're going to get hurt. And I've been that way since I was a kid. But anyway, he tells me, he says, well, come on out front here. I got to give you some tests. And I told him, no, I'm not going to be your dancing bear tonight. And I just rolled over onto the hood and put my hands behind my back, and he handcuffed me. And he tells me, he says, how many of these you got? I said, a lot. And I told him, just keep me. Just keep me this time. Just keep me. I was tired. I was tired of everything. I was tired of drinking. I was tired of being loaded. I was tired of running. I was tired of the disgust look in my wife's face. I was tired of my kids being there, and I couldn't do anything for them because I was inebriated all the time. Might just keep me. They did. They obliged me. I ended up doing a year for those. While I was locked up, I was locked up with this guy named Pete, and I'm a painter. Now I'm a painting contractor. I was a painter. I tried not to paint today, but I still have to sometimes. But we were locked up in the county jail for the DUIs and the fines and everything, and because I maxed out, I didn't want probation, I didn't want fines. I told him, I got nothing going on, so just keep me. And there's more to that story, but I ain't going to get into that. So I went in there and I did the time. I was getting close to getting out, and Pete was getting out like 30 days before me. And he said, hey, what are you doing when you get out? I said, I don't know, man. I said, before jail, I was underneath a bridge. And he says, well, if you don't got nowhere to go when you get out, man, he says, I'm going to go to this recovery home in Santa Maria. And he said, you come up there, man, I'll get you a place to stay. And I said, because if I go back, I'm just going to go back doing what I do, you know. And he says, nah, man, he says, if you don't got nowhere to go, you just come on to Santa Maria. But I had this idea that, you know, I was going to get out of jail, and my wife would see what the changed man I was. And I would get to go home and be a dad and a husband, and I would change my ways and everything would be good. And when I got out of jail, it took me 2 days to find her, and I found her, and she had other plans, you know. And she was done with me, and I don't blame her. I put that woman through hell. And nobody should have to suffice what I put her through, you know. And I've made amends to her several times since then. We're friends today, somewhat. At least when we're facing each other. And I have a great deal of respect for her, you know, today. So I get out of jail, man, and I remember I was like 1 day, 2 days of getting out, and Duffy walks by and he's like, hey, D, he says, man, he says, you're getting short, right? I said, I'm getting out in a couple of days. He goes, where are you going? I said, I don't know, can I stay? Because I was scared. For the first time in my life, I was scared. Where am I going? I'm going back to Salvation Army and the bridge. I'm going back to drinking and using and doing what I do, and I'm going to die or end up doing life, you know? Because I know the minute I get out, I'm going to hook up with Chewy or Louie or Dewey, and I'm going to take a drink, and I'm going to take a hit, and I'm going to shoot some stuff, and I'm going to do something, man, and I'm going to be off and running, and the end won't be good again. It's just a matter of time. And I wanted to stay in jail, but they wouldn't let me. I was a good prisoner. And so I get out, man, and I meet with my wife, let's see. I'm 55 years old now, man. I can't see a damn clock. It's only 9 o'clock. We got time. And she's like, no, man, you ain't coming around. I don't want you here. You know, you can see your kids, meet me on the police station, meet me on the steps of the police station, because she was afraid of me. And at that period of my life, she had every right to be. I was not a nice guy back then at all. I never beat women, but they were afraid of me. And they seen what I was doing. And she was like, you meet me on the steps of the police department and you can see your kids. So I met her on the steps of the police department and I seen my kids. And then I got in the car and I was like, I want to go with you. And she's like, no, you ain't going with me. And she drug me out of that car and left me on the sidewalk and drove away. And I remember my little girl in the back seat screaming, daddy, 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 daddy. And I was just watching her drive off. And so anyway, I panhandled some money and I caught a cop a one-way bus ticket to Santa Maria because I had an address in my hand from the guy that I was locked up with. And I get to Santa Maria and I get off the bus and I find out where this address is and I go down there and it's a recovery home and I go in and I tell the guy, I says, yeah, man, is Pete here? And he's all, no, he's at work. And I was like, well, he said if I came here, I could get a place to live. And he's all, well, how'd you, we talked a little bit. And he's all, how'd you get like this? Or how'd you get here? And I said, well, I took the bus. He's all, nah, man, how'd your life get like this? And I kind of shared a little bit with him. And he asked me for money. I didn't have no money. And he believed in me, you know. He believed in me. And he let me stay there. And I told him, let me stay. I'll have a job tomorrow. And I got a job the next day. Started going to meetings. I had been in and around Alcoholics Anonymous for 7 years, but I'd never got any time together. I didn't want to be sober. I wanted to be loaded. I came here to get the heat off, to satisfy the wife, the job, the courts, whatever it was. My first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, a friend of mine had been murdered on a bad drug deal, and his mom was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she begged me at the funeral to go to a meeting because she thought I would be next. She said, please, Daryl, do this for me. So I went to that meeting, and when I was at that meeting, I mean, you know, all I remember is that people were like, you know, if you want what we have and you're willing to go anything to get it, you know, and I'm just saying, man, I don't know what the hell you got, but you can keep it, you know. I was like, I can do this. Yeah, no, I do. Because not only am I an addict alcoholic, I suffer from terminal coolness, too. And I didn't want none of that, you know. But I fulfilled the promise. And that was my introduction to AA, but. So I'm in the recovery home, and it was good, you know, because we went to a lot of meetings, you know, and we got step work, and they, you know, for the first time in my life, I was like, okay, I'm going to do this, you know, and I had Bill P as a sponsor, and I was doing pretty good, and I come home from work one day, man, and I went upstairs to use the bathroom on the door, and there's a dude in the toilet doing this, you know, and I looked at that, and he goes, you want some? And I was like, I'm out of here, and I grabbed my bag, and I was gone. You know, because I wasn't there by court. I was a volunteer there. So I just left. I didn't say anything. One of the coordinators was like, hey, what are you doing? I got to go. Because I knew if I turned around, I was going to be loaded. And I left. At 9 months of sobriety, I relapsed. I've had one relapse since I got sober. I'm not one of those guys that came in and out. I came in and stayed loaded. And I didn't play games about it, you know. And when I was in Santa Barbara, I'd go to a meeting and I'd take a hit off a whiskey bottle and a hit off a crack pipe and go sit in the thing. They had these pillars on the walls and I'd lean my head against it and I'd be like this. And the old timers would tell the newcomers, see that right there? That's what you're going to look like if you don't stay clean sober. And I wasn't playing games. I just was lost. So anyway, I relapsed at 9 months. And 3 days to get my 9-1 chip, I went to Santa Barbara and I ran into a cat that I knew and I ended up relapsing. And I came back the next day and Ray J showed up at my job and took me to a meeting that night. And that night, Richard was there and Ray says, you know, Daryl, he says, man, if you want to save your life, you might want to ask Richard to be your sponsor. And I'm like, not him. I'm not. Can I pick anybody else? No. But I did. I went up and I asked him, you know, and he says, well, here's my number. He says, are you willing to take refuge from somebody other than yourself? And I told him, maybe. That's all the best I could do. And he says, here's my number. Call me every day for 30 days and don't miss a day. You miss a day, you start over. And I'm like, ooh. I think it took me 90 days to get 30 days. So the guys I sponsor, when it took you 90 days, don't worry about it, man.
But you know, man, one thing with Richard is he's been there since day one, and we don't always agree on things, man, but we always treat each other with dignity and respect. And I have a great love and admiration for that man, because God's used that man to change my life, to give me the life I have today, and to give me the ability to decipher and discern the process of recovery through the 12 steps with the enlightenment and the empowerment of God that takes place inside of me as a result of this thing. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have that, you know. Maybe God would have placed someone else, but he didn't. He placed him. And right, wrong, or indifferent, I'll always have a love for that guy. He's like a brother to me. And, you know, this has not been easy, man. You know, just because you're clean and sober, that life isn't like, oh, you know, da-da-da-da-da, you know. I mean, it gets real around here, you know. I got sober when I was 27 years old, and now I'm 27 years sober. I'm like a pilled zero, you know. And these last 10 years have just been long. Oh God, let me stop. You know, when I had 5 years, I met a woman in recovery, and we got married, and we've been together for 20 years, and Four years ago, she came to me and she asked me about having a baby, and I didn't want to have babies. I have two kids and I love them, you know, but I was done having kids, and she wanted to have a kid, and I didn't want to have a kid, and it was a major ordeal. In fact, I did leave, and then I came back, because I got to the point inside of me that I thought, you know, for me to deprive this woman of having a baby is a selfish act on my part. She has a right to be a mother, and if she wants to have a baby, then I need to allow that because she's my wife. This is the type of mentality and maturity that recovery had brought into an insane mind. Because prior to recovery, I had an insane mind. I could not rationalize that kind of stuff. And so we set out to have a baby. But that part wasn't so bad, but you know. But we started having miscarriages, you know, and we had like 3 miscarriages in a year, and it was kind of weird, you know. So she thought, well, something must be wrong, and so, you know, of course, because I'm the alcoholic drug addict in the life I've lived and in the path that I've done, she was just, got to be something wrong with you, and, you probably got some bacteria growing in you. You know? See, I put so much stuff in me, there ain't nothing growing in me, you know. It's a magic. I'm still amazed my body's breathing. And I'm not a vegetable staring out of a window somewhere. Somebody wiping drool off my mouth, you know. Maybe I am, and you guys are just being nice. But you know, so we set out to do that. It turned out that she had a disorder, an immune system disorder, and she would get pregnant, and her body would kill the fetus. And it was kind of weird because we were going to a specialist, and there just happened to be this guy that was from Europe that specialized in this kind of stuff, and he checked her out, and he was like, I know what's up. He got a killed immune system disorder, and I got the treatment for it. And so we started this treatment, and she was doing IVG treatments 4 days a week where they were putting an infusion into her blood to neutralize her immune system, and then we went and we did in vitro, and that's crazy. I mean, I'm a street kid from Norwalk. I'm like, you guys are freaking me out, you know? Not like a test rat. I'm like, God, how did I get here? You know? I was just walking down the street asking for change a few years ago, you know? And so, yeah, we do this, and they tell me we're going to plant 4 eggs. I'm like, no, you ain't. You know? I'll go 2, we ain't going 4, because that means that's a 4 possibility, you know. And I'm 42 years old at this time. And we had our son, you know, it worked, it took, and we had our son. And God, I love that kid, man. He is like, I was so afraid to have him. You know, because my father died in my arms when I was 18 years old, and that was my story. I was born, my dad was like 39 years old, 40 years old, and he got cancer and died before I got grown up. I never had that opportunity to have an adult conversation with him, and I was afraid of that happening to this kid, and that's why I didn't want to have the kid. And anyway, we had the kid. 7 days after she had the kid, she started hemorrhaging, and I took her to the doctor, and they said, oh, well, you know, it was a C-section, and, you know, maybe it was normal, and, you know, just go back home. And so we went back home, and I had the baby. The baby was 7 days old, and I had the baby in the hand, and I heard her scream, and I went in the bedroom, and there was blood everywhere. I mean, it was just everywhere. And she looked at me, and her eyes went fixed, and she fell into me, and I had her not breathing out and my baby, and I'm like, you know, and I rolled her onto the bed, and I set the baby on the floor, and I gave her CPR and chest percussions, and I finally got her to cough, and I hit 911, and I called a friend, told me, you need to go over here and get the baby. Lisa's dying. There's blood everywhere. And it just seemed like I was in a time warp, and before I knew it, the paramedics were there. My friend was there. She had the baby, and we were gone off to the hospital, and we spent the next 4 days in ICU, and she had what was called DIC, disseminated vagus disorder. Her blood wasn't coagulating, and she was bleeding out as fast as they could put blood into her. It was going out of her, and they came to me on the fourth day, and they said, if it don't stop, she's going to die. So you might want to get a hold of a pastor if you want. And I'm like, you're going to be kidding me. This woman's 30-something years old. She runs 10 miles a day. She's got 2 degrees from UCSB. It just can't be happening. We got a baby 7 days old. And it was happening. And they were like, yeah, well, the kidneys are shutting down, the lungs are shutting down, the brain's starting to swell. If the brain starts to bleed, we're going to lose her. Nothing we can do about it. And I don't know what to do, man. And I'm at the hospital. All of a sudden, I look up and Richard's standing there, you know. And he goes, what do you want to do, homie? I'm all, let's walk. And we hit the parking lot, and we circled that hospital like 50 times, just in a circle, just talking, looking at the ground, talking, I know what to do. I'm like, this can't be happening, Richard. This can't be happening. She's going to die. They told me she's going to die. And then I'm like, I can't believe God's going to do that to that little kid. And he's going to leave him with me. And he don't deserve that. And also, I passed the chapel, you know, and then I seen chapel. And I went in there, and I got on my knees. And I said, God, just let me take her spot, man. And I prayed for her. And I prayed drastically. And then they came back, and we were back up in the hospital, in the room, and they came back, and they told me, they said, well, you know what, it's not looking good, and we're going to give her till 4:30 in the morning. If the bleeding don't stop by 4:30, you're going to have to make a decision to pull the plug. And it was probably about 2 o'clock in the morning. I was in there, and I laid hands on her, and I was praying for her, and the nurse tapped me on the shoulder, and she goes, Mr. Nelson. And I turned around. She goes, the bleeding stopped 30 minutes ago. And I just was like, what? She goes, she's going to be all right. And I was like, and you know, it was like they had her in a coma for the whole time, so she slept through it. She didn't know what happened to her, and I did, because I watched it. I watched every second of it, and in like 2 hours she was awake, you know, and they woke her up. They said, we don't know what's going to happen, and she might be brain dead. They never had nobody survive it at that level. Everybody always died. They made a test study of her, Shortly after that, she relapsed, and she's never made it back. And I'm a single father, and I raised my son by myself. And there's nothing I can do about that, you know, except pray for her, you know. And you know, the miracle and all that, and the reason I share that, I've never shared that openly in a meeting. My close friends know about it. Some of them experienced it. Is because to be able to endure that kind of internal pain and fear and not want to get loaded, not have to run to anesthetize those feelings and emotions, is a miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? Because I can't do that of my own self, man. I gotta go. I gotta run. I can't not. You know? And I got a lot more to say, and I'm kind of running out of time. But You know, these last 10 years has taught me a lot. It's forced me to grow up, you know. And today I'm doing things right, man. I'm not running amok. I own a business. I run the business. I take care of some rentals. I take care of my son. I'm a soccer dad, a football dad. I was doing football coaching. I'm a thug from Norwalk, you know. And I don't know. I don't even know how to play football. I don't even watch football. I'm a 49ers fan. But I'll do anything for this kid, man. You know, and I look at him and he's 12 years old, and I was running amok at 12. 12 years old, I was slinging dope in the parks and boosting bottles from Alpha Beta. And I look at my son, he's 12 years old and he's innocent. And he's a straight-A student. He goes to a Christian school. He's an excellent athlete. The coaches are calling me constantly. Is he playing this? Is he playing that? We want him on this team. And I'm just like, I tell him, Jake, you want to go do this? He's like, yes, let's go do it, you know. And I arrange my schedule and my life around him, and I'm going to do that until he's raised, you know. And I think back, I think I did it when I had it, because I wanted my life. I wanted to take off on my bike and go tour and do what I want, you know. And God gave me what I needed, you know. That kid has saved my life so many times these last 10 years. If it was not for him, there's no doubt in my mind, I may not be loaded, but I would be in a bad place with bad people doing bad things. Because at 18 years of sobriety, I was not living these principles. I had unworked them, and I had put myself in the realms of some pretty dark stuff. And by the grace of God, I had a moment of clarity, and I didn't have to drink over it, you know, and I changed everything in my life, you know. I've changed my playgrounds, playmates, and playthings at 20 years of recovery. Changed my friends. I changed where I go. I still ride my bike, but I do it by myself, and I stay out of those realms. You know, there's something that I want to read here. It's one of the, to me, the most powerful part of the big book. And it's at the end of page 84, and it goes on to the end of page 85. It says, "And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned, and we will seldom be interested in liquor, or in my case, drugs too. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. We're not, I can't drink. No. No. That's not what it is here, people. We have a solution. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. It is easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We are headed for trouble if we do. For alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, Lord, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. I'm Daryl, I'm alcoholic."
So You guys heard Orchid and you were worried, huh? Great job.